Welcome to Studio 2 on a Thursday. I'm Cherry Gregg.
On a Thursday, I'm Avi Wolfman-Arrett. On a Friday, who will I be? I don't know.
That same
hopefully
person.
Still Avi Wolfman-Arrett.
We'll check in.
So on sure. Thursday, on this Thursday, May 16th, what are we talking about today, Cherry? Well, the big segment today is all about music and the music industry specifically.
Yeah, it's changed so much over the years.
It always feels like it's in flux, but perhaps never more so than now. So we're going to talk big picture about the music industry, but we're going to have sort of like a local flavor to it, talking to an expert from Drexel and a local artist who can give us the Philly lens on the big changes.
Yeah, I'm excited about this because back in the day, and I still have them. Hundreds of CDs.
Where do you
probably
keep your CDs?
They're
now?
Probably in the basement in a storage closet somewhere at
probably.
This point.
Because let's check up on them.
Yeah, I gotta find them. But I spent all this money on them, so I refuse to throw them out. And now I listen to all my favorite artists on streaming.
We have, for reasons I cannot comprehend, one of those. It's like a binder type thing that you would travel. You would stick CDs in to travel with in your car. We still have it in our car. We haven't used it in years.
Do you have a CD player in your car?
Yes, we do.
Okay.
But we never put the CDs in them. They're just, this little binder thing is just sitting in the trunk, taking up space. I guess it's a nice reminder.
Yeah.
Of
a simpler time.
If you have a favorite album.
Yeah. And how do you support your favorite artist?
How do you support your favorite artist? Maybe a favorite music memory, a Philly music memory. We'd love to fold those into the show today. 888-477-9499, email studio2@whyy.org. Do you have a favorite album, by the way? Putting you on the spot?
I don't off the top, but I have people in rotation.
Okay.
You know, like, it's because of streaming. The way I listen to music has changed, and I have playlists now.
Playlists.
Yeah.
Playlists over albums.
Yes.
Perhaps we'll talk about that. Mm-hmm. We're also going to talk about Pennsylvania Native Species Day, which is today. Now, that doesn't apply to me. I'm a native species of Arkansas.
Oh,
but
okay.
There are plenty of great local native plants, and there is a growing movement to encourage people to plant them because it helps our ecosystem, and we're going to talk with an expert about that.
And we're going to have to put a pin in on that Arkansas statement because I'm like,
I was born in Arkansas.
I didn't know that. Look, I learned something new about you every
day. I am an Arkansan. I can prove it. I've got the documentation.
All right.
So before we get into any of that, though.
Yeah.
Cherry, I'm surprised you couldn't tell by my thick southern drawl. let's do some headlines.
Yeah, quick update on the Bob Menendez trial. Opening statements began yesterday afternoon. In that trial, of course, the senator is accused of taking extravagant bribes in exchange for political influence. But news broke today when Menendez released a statement saying his wife, Nadine, who is also charged in that case, is being treated for cancer and will undergo a mastectomy. He has asked for her privacy, but this announcement is very curious because her defense attorneys put her, the Mrs. Menendez, at the center of their case. They blamed her for the senator's legal problems. They described her as beautiful and tall international woman who Bob, quote, fell for. They said the couple lived separate lives with separate bank accounts and that the senator was in the dark about Nadine's finances and business deals. They said those gold bars that everybody been talking to were Nadine's. He says they were found in her locked closet and that Menendez knew about them, but he says he thought they came from her family. His attorneys maintain Menendez's total innocence at this point.
Yeah, so the legal and emotional entanglements here, especially with this latest announcement about the cancer diagnosis, are kind of beyond comprehension and commentary. So I think I'm just going to leave it there today and we'll keep following this case. Is
that
fair?
Yeah, and we'll say that. And we'll also mention that her trial is set at this point to begin in July because the trials are now separate because of her illness.
Moving to Delaware now, where you cannot, for the moment, get a vanity license plate.
Mm-hmm.
Now, why is that? That's because there is an ongoing lawsuit that just reached at least a temporary decision point. Let's backtrack. December 2020, a cancer survivor in Delaware named Carrie Lynn Overington applies for a license plate that says F Cancer. She receives it. But then, in June 2021, The DMV in Delaware says we're taking it back because we believe it's obscene. Now, she says the F in F cancer stands for fight. Mm. Of course, some people would imply another F word there, and that's why it was revoked. She decides to sue with the help of the ACLU, and a district judge has now ruled in her favor, saying that the state has violated her First Amendment rights and that their rules around obscenity and deciding which license plates to throw out and which to accept are vague and arbitrary. So for the moment, no one's getting a vanity license plate in Delaware as they sort through all of this.
Yeah, it's very interesting because, you know, I love First Amendment.
That's
sure one
do.
Of the few things that I'm like advocate for. And it seemed a little arbitrary here, and that's why they want some clarification on these rules. But the regulations state that the plates that make unflattering statements about a group or raise politically sensitive issues should be referred to administrators in Dover, who will then look at them and decide whether or not the plate should be issued. They also said that no vanity plate shall be issued that is considered obscene. But, you know, in legal circles, the word obscenity, people say you know it when you see it. So yeah. It's always very arbitrary. And I mean, this is a cancer survivor. She's very involved. And for her, she really wanted to say fight cancer.
Right.
On her, allegedly, fight cancer on her, you know, plate. So right now, everybody's going to suffer in Delaware until they figure this out.
Although apparently she gets her plates back.
Yeah.
She gets the F cancer because everyone who has one is grandfathered in for the moment. And they're saying apparently she gets hers back.
So
our producers would like us to note that if they were to get a vanity license plate, and this is in the future when Delaware allows this again, it would read Stu 2, the number 2, forever.
EVA, forever.
That's not bad. Do you have a vanity license plate that you would go with?
I do not.
I don't have one off the top of my head. I like Stu 2 forever.
I
That's
like
not bad.
Stu 2 forever, and then we could be Stu 2 forever.
How about
one
this
and
one?
Two, or
How about
A
this
B?
One? How about this one? Hi, the word hi, space, letter T. Hi, T.
Oh.
Because that gets us to our next story.
That does. I'm taking it you like tea and finger sandwiches because
you are.
You can get both. As sightseeing in Philly has gotten a little classier now that there's a British-themed high tea bus. The Philadelphia Inquirer's Jen Ladd recently rode along and reviewed the experience. I know I love high tea, and I lean in with a little fascinator on my head. I love all that.
Stop. So it's a bus.
Yes.
It's a high tea bus. You got to explain this.
The tea around town bus lets tourists, they sip Earl Grey and English breakfast tea, and they nibble on these finger sandwiches and scones while they soak in the sights of Philadelphia, everything from the Liberty Bell to the Art Museum. And from the review in the Inquirer, people dressed the part. They had on springtime pastel dresses. They had on lace gloves and colorful hats. And it's a double-decker bus. It's decorated with the tea party on the outside and with flowers and pink booths inside. The tickets run about $85 to $125, depending on your package. But you get salmon crostinis, lobster top pastry puffs, all that kind of stuff. Don't you like that, Avi?
Are you serious?
I'm just saying. Food.
Are you want me to answer honestly?
I mean, you like food.
I cannot imagine a worse setting to drink a hot beverage than on a moving bus.
I know, there's a three-tier China stand. So
it
I don't know how that
like
works.
Such an... It's so incongruous. You want everything around you to be stable when you're drinking something hot and
but
eating delicate
plastic,
food.
And just to be clear, the tea comes not in China teacups, but plastic tumblers.
Because we have
a lot of potholes.
It is hot.
And it could spill. But you know how people want to do, man. It's a chance to dress up.
Story number two is about a lawsuit, and perhaps someday story number three will be about a different lawsuit. We shall see. Very quickly, I wanted to mention something that happened at the Philadelphia Union game last night in Chester, Pennsylvania. Let's set the scene. It's the first half. They're playing soccer. All of a sudden, the soccer stops because there's a raccoon on the field. And this raccoon was there for about 3 minutes, evading capture until finally, in a very ingenious way, I might add, the grounds crew was able to apprehend the raccoon. Here is play-by-play announcer Dave Leno with the call.
And he's trying to get the trash can. We can't get it. The raccoon's still alive. Oh, and finally, it's delivered by the grounds crew. Puts the trash can above the raccoon. That was a raucous performance by Mr. Raccoon.
give it up for Mr. Raccoon.
And
he had quite a night and apparently was released into the wild and from what we know is doing fine and had a lovely Wednesday evening at the soccer stadium.
I love it. And it made me think about, made me look up all the times that animals have interrupted sports.
Yeah, it's happened a bunch.
It's happened quite often. It's not very unusual, but go raccoon.
Wait, you looked this up?
I looked this up. And
give me some.
A kangaroo made its way on a racetrack in Australia back in 2004.
I didn't know that.
A real rabbit once made its way into a greyhound race. You know, they used like little fake rabbits and everybody went running into the woods. All the dogs went running into the woods. Also, skunks have interfered with minor league baseball. Alligators have popped up on golf courses.
Sure.
And of course, bugs invaded one of the ADLS games back in 2007, and seagulls and foxes, they've stolen golf balls as well. So
I know
animals
the
interrupt.
One I know off the top of my head is that for whatever reason, multiple times, bats have interrupted basketball games, specifically in San Antonio.
Indoor basketball? They just
yes,
out here
they get in there and then they fly around. And in fact, one time I believe one of the players caught the bat with his hand.
That's
you can look that up on Google.
That's I gotta bat, see that.
Bat San Antonio and I think Manu Ginobili. I think those keywords will get it done for you.
Wow.
Raccoons, by the way, are a native to North America.
Native,
I believe
yeah.
a native species. And we want to talk about native species.
Yeah, because
now.
It's Native Species Day in the Keystone State. It's a day to celebrate our diverse native ecosystem of native plants, trees, insects, and animals. And our Department of Agriculture named this holiday 2 years ago, hoping to aid our understanding of the importance of protecting these crucial members of our local landscape.
Now, invasive species that did not originate in our region are a major threat to native plants and pollinators. But there are a lot of ways for us to help. And joining us now in the studio is Tom Knizik. He is the president of Pinelands Nursery and co-host of the Native Plants Healthy Planet podcast. Tom Knizik, welcome to Studio 2.
Yeah, thank you guys for having me. I'd love to talk more about the raccoon because I can't
please.
Believe they did that on Native Species Day Eve. No less.
I know.
Kicked him out. He's trying to celebrate, get ready.
Yeah,
he's
exactly.
got his little raccoon family someplace.
Exactly, so. Exactly. Oh. Very much counter to the spirit of, we'll bring that up with the union next time we get an audience with
I
them.
Know, that's right. And so, Tom, I want you to sort of lay the foundation and help us define this world of native plants and what does it mean when we use this term, and could you give us some examples in our region?
Yeah, so one thing first is I have probably hours and hours and hours of information that I got to cram into like a little tiny bag. So there's way more than I'll ever be able to say here. But a native plant is basically a plant that was here prior, the technical deadline is prior to colonization.
Mm-hmm.
So you think Christopher Columbus, 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue, that kind of thing. That's kind of the date that we use to plants that were here before then. And all species that were here before then are considered native species. Plants that were here after then are considered non-native species. And why that is because basically people and humans and animals, they were always moving plants around. There's things they like to eat. But what used to take years or decades or even centuries to move a plant hundreds or thousands of miles now was happening transcontinentally within a much shorter time period.
Yeah, months, everything gets condensed.
Months in a lot of yeah. And now today, it's you'll have container ships that take a month to come across the ocean from China, and they have different insects or different plant species that'll be attached to gravel or in boxes and that kind of stuff on accident, typically. It's not purposefully. The horticultural industry with plants, well, we want to have beautiful lawns and or beautiful yards, so we're bringing over exotic plants.
Mm.
And some of those have become invasive species, as you mentioned before.
So what's
not
the,
all,
what's the problem there? So when we bring over these plants that look nice and plant them in our yard, what happens?
Well, it's a really complicated problem. And a lot of it is really man-made, as we've created more disturbance by building cities and warehouses and housing developments, that kind of stuff, gone into our woods and kind of done some different things. And then you come... Combine that with the deer problem, we have a lot of openings in our ecosystems where there used to not be openings. And so some of these plants have, the non-native plants have taken advantage of that. Things like Japanese barberry is one, burning bush, Bradford pear. We just got through Bradford pear season. That's the really nice white flowers.
Yeah, I have one outside my house. Yeah.
Smell pretty stinky if you're... I'm not going to describe how they smell. I won't go into that. This is a NPR show. I can't talk about it here. But so those kind of things kind of took advantage of... not purposely. They're not, they don't aren't thinking, oh, we're going to spread. All these species are trying to spread in some way. They're the ones that have just kind of maximized on the openings in the ecosystem because where there used to be a shrub, a native shrub, now the deer have eaten them all because there's too many deer, and there's an opening for that Japanese barberry seed, which a bird picked off in someone's yard and then sits on a branch, and the seed comes out the other end lands in that opening, and that's now you have a Japanese barberry, which the native species can't really eat. And it's not just the native herbivores that you're thinking of, or the mammals and birds and that kind of stuff. It's the insects are the real key here. There's so many native insects that can't eat a lot of these non-native or invasive species.
And so let's talk about, give us a couple of examples of, you know, native species for this region, and then sort of like why are they so important? And you started touching on it with the insects.
Yeah, yeah. So some of the native species that you'll commonly see are things like red maples, really common street tree. People have them in their yards. There's a lot of different varieties which have different colors to red maples. Oak trees. There's a lot of native oaks, specifically white oaks, red oaks, blackjack oaks, if you get into the Pine Barrens in New Jersey. Then you have a lot of different shrubs. So arrowwood viburnum is one. And then lots of different flowers. Lots of different flowers that people know. Like I'm used to talking in botanical names, and not everyone knows botanical names. So I'm trying to think of common names as I go. But
wild bergamot, is that one?
Wild bergamot's one.
Hoary mountain mint.
Hoary mountain mint's another great one. You have like purple coneflower is a species that's native to the U.S., but not necessarily native to where we are, but it's a really common garden plant. Some of your monardas, the bee bombs that you mentioned before. So species like that are native to this area, also really beautiful flowers, and then provide a lot of forage for our native insects, either both pollinators, so your bees and butterflies, but also the caterpillars and larval stages of those insects, which is probably more important.
Yeah. So how do I get started? I've got, let's say, just a standard lawn, and I want to start filling in with native species because I want to play my part here. What do I do?
Yeah, so first thing is really you want to look at your yard space. And you may have garden beds already. That's a good place to start filling in with some of these native species. If you have lawn, think about what parts of your lawn you use versus what you don't use. Well, you think about lawns. We mow, we do, spend all this money trying to make them perfect just so that our neighbors don't look at us and give us a stink eye when they're driving by, right? But lawns are good for people to play on and that kind of thing, but or kids to play on. But my front yard, how much of it do I actually walk on? So start thinking about some of those spots at your lawn where maybe you start putting in some of these native species instead. So what you're going to do is put in start with flowers. If you have space for an oak tree, oak trees provide forage for so many different caterpillars, which then feed the birds and all these other mammals, and they're the base of the food web, really.
Mm. I got to ask you this question from Connie on the invasive species. Connie asked, there's an invasive species in New Jersey called aquatic yellow flag, and it's so pretty that people don't want to get rid of it. How do you convince folks to get rid of these attractive plants when they're invasive?
Oh, yeah. That's a really tricky one. Because people have attachments to these plants, and they don't know the whole backstory with how these plants got here, one, and then, two, some of the damage that they're doing to our ecosystems by taking spaces that native species could occupy. So a lot of it is just having a friendly conversation with them. You want to approach them with kindness. You don't want to say, you're a bad person because you're letting these plants grow. That's just going to make them want to plant more. You look at all the other factors of your life where that happens. When you're approached with anger, you get defensive. So you don't want to approach with anger. But it's kind of one of the things we always recommend is give a native plant as a gift. Mm-hmm. Say, hey, this is something. I saw you have this plant. This is a blue flag iris is one of our native irises. This is a plant that grows in the same conditions and also looks equally beautiful, and it also provides habitat and food for all these other insects or wildlife, all that kind of stuff.
The art of persuasion. Yeah. As we wrap up, if I start planting these native species, how do I ensure they're not crowded out by invasives after I plant them?
A lot of it is just use an app called iNaturalist is a good one.
iNaturalist.
Then you have the Seek app is another one. Even Google, if you take a picture on your phone and you swipe up, it'll actually identify somewhat accurately the plants on your phone. So kind of take an idea of what's happening in your yard, and then you can vet, is this a good plant or a bad plant?
There you go. Use technology,
yes,
to help return us to our natural state.
I love it. Interesting interplay there.
That's yes. Tom Kinezik, president of Pinelands Nursery and co-host of the Native Plants Healthy Planet podcast. Tom, we appreciate the time.
Yeah. No, thank you guys for having me.
Learn something new today. I really love it. Coming up next, our roundtable on the music industry. We'll be right back. And be sure to email us your favorite album, how you support your favorite artist, studio2@whyy.org.
The bright, blessed day, the dark, sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Supporting WHYY, the Chamber of Commerce for Greater Philadelphia. Funded by the Knight Foundation, the Chamber announces its Leading the Way, Cell and Gene Therapy in Greater Philadelphia report. More at chmbr.biz/CGTPHL.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Cherry, remember the good old days? You went to a record store or a CD store?
I do.
To get your hands on something you were so excited to hear.
Showing up at midnight, waiting in line.
For what album?
That was the Biggie Smalls album after he died. Life After Death. I remember waiting in line at midnight because it was like, it came out like a couple months after he passed away. Yeah. So it's kind of crazy.
And you waited at midnight for that
album? I waited at midnight and I got it. I still have it. In a box somewhere.
I don't think I ever did that, but I was very excited to get, what was the big Will Smith album? Was it Big Willie Style? Willennium? Something like that. So, someone gave that to me as a gift. I think that was my first CD.
Go ahead. Look, the memories, right? So, but a lot of times people are not buying albums anymore. But I will say records are not totally dead, okay? Mm-hmm. Taylor Swift, for instance, just sold a record number of vinyl albums. But obviously, you know, everybody's not Taylor Swift, and we are clearly in a world where most of us listen to our favorite artists via streaming platforms. I know I do.
We've got old formats. We've got new formats. We are still kind of feeling our way into the future of music. So to help us, we invited a local panel of music professionals to give us some behind-the-scenes perspective on the state of the industry. With us in studio are Jeff Apruzzi, Program Director of the Music Industry Program at the Antoinette Westfall College of Media Arts and Design at Drexel University, and Brielle Kimmons, a local recording artist also known as April Fool Child. Jeff, Brielle, welcome to Studio 2.
Hello.
Hi.
Yeah, and standing by, we have Joey Sweeney, Creative Director of 48 Record Bar, a listening bar in Philadelphia. And he will explain to us why vinyl is so hot right now. Also, listeners, if you are a musician or music enthusiast and you want to chime in, give us a call. How do you consume music these days? And how do you support your favorite artists? Call us 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org.
Let's start with an email here, actually, from Clarence, who says, I'm one of those who still has LPs, 45s, CDs. I like the feel of choosing my music, picking up the CD or vinyl and playing it. I don't care for streaming because they're missing the human touch. And yes, I can hear the difference, so says Clarence. Okay, so that's Clarence's perspective. But Jeff Apruzzi, how do musicians actually make money these days? I can't imagine a huge chunk is from those old school formats, but maybe I'm wrong.
A variety of ways, I would say. One way I often like to describe it, especially to our students, is that instead of, you know, in these old school days of an artist signs to a record label, gets a big fat advance, records a record and tours, we have a much varied resources now to all the different revenue streams. And unfortunately, streaming has not been a direct replacement for physical sales. But just to give a little bit of ballpark right now, the recorded music industry is currently a $28.9 billion industry globally. And physical actually makes up about $5.1 billion of that. Okay. So almost 20% of the recorded music industry globally still is a physical format.
And then streaming is most of the rest?
Streaming makes up about 60% of that, yeah. But unfortunately, you know, it is not a direct replacement. We're talking about pennies per stream, fractional pennies per stream, if you will. So it's coming from a lot of different places. More artists are forced to tour, and we've seen those headlines now just even increase costs with tour. Artists doing licensing, branding deals, sync deals. There's a lot of different areas now that have opened up to increase some of that lost revenue.
So it sounds like a lot of little revenue streams instead of like that one big chunk.
Yeah, correct.
Which feels a little precarious, or it would for me as an artist, but maybe some artists like that model.
I think it really depends a lot now. What I'm seeing is ways of engaging with the fan base, right? And I think the fan base is truly this place now. So take TikTok, for example, right? If we rewind back to 2020, the music industry was sort of looking at TikTok as this development platform, right? You can find artists from there. They can develop a fan base. What they found was that a lot of the artists that were popping off on TikTok had never played a show before. They didn't know how to play an instrument, right? And so what now has happened, fast forward about 4 years, is that authenticity is really the key. And so artists are really finding unique ways to connect with their fan bases a lot more, and figuring out ways to, for lack of a better sense, monetize those relationships in a more direct-to-consumer way versus having to worry about this vast commercial viability that we might have seen in the recorded music industry in 1999.
Interesting.
Yeah. And so, Brielle, we want to bring you into the conversation. Tell us a little bit about your story, how you got into the industry.
Yeah, thank you for having me. So I always had an interest in music as a kid and spent time developing, like, you know, training and being in choir and singing. And then as I got older, found resources like Berklee. Berklee had a summer program, and that's how I started there, getting acclimated to what it's like to be a performer, be around other instrumentalists, and start learning about the industry. And from there, creating organic relationships. So finding pockets within the music world that fit my sound, booking shows, even if they were small shows, and just building an organic network, like Jeff said. And then from there, finding that the best way for me was to put out music independently. I did have an opportunity to work with Universal, and I felt like a very small fish in a large ocean. I just wasn't getting the resources I needed to kind of move from, you know, that independent kind of DIY artist to the next level. But I found that the relationships I built with my community was strong, and I could continue to put out music just by myself. So I used like DistroKid, which is accessible to lots of artists.
Can you explain what that is?
Yeah, so it's a distribution hub company that you can access as any independent artist. You just sign up, you pay for basically like an annual service fee, and you upload your music, which is great, and it syncs automatically to PROs. So it's going to track your performance royalties so you can get paid. Yeah. And like Jeff said, right, like we're getting pennies, but there's a lot of great ways to, you know, sell your music to your fans.
And that's what I want to ask you, because Jeff sort of laid out that there's multiple streams of income coming in for artists. So how do you as an artist create enough multiple streams of income where you can support your actual life?
Sure. You definitely got to get crafty. So I would say being organized is a great way to create opportunity. Go through your catalog, have it set up, reach out to different agencies, like sync agencies. They love discovering new artists, especially like, you know, independent, little different sounds. So I took my catalog and I pitched it to an agency called Mad and Flow. And so they work for me. So whenever opportunity comes up and it fits like a commercial, an ad, an indie film or TV that works for my sound, they'll reach out and say, hey, we have an opportunity for you.
So licensing.
Yes,
of your
licensing.
Music. Yeah.
There's also a really great vinyl opportunity that I found called Least of All, where you go to New York and you record something from your catalog, which is a great way to engage with your fans. And you're cutting this music live with your band, and it's a one of one record. So your fan feels like, wow, I got this really special, amazing custom thing. And it doesn't cost the artist any overhead money to make the music. You're splitting it with the distribution.
So. Interesting.
All the stuff that you're describing, Brielle, I'm imagining like, even 10, 20 years ago, you would need an agent and a manager and all the resources of a big record company to make a lot of this stuff happen. And now it's so much more, it sounds like, decentralized. So then, Jeff, I ask you, what is the role of the big record company these days? Do they still have a role?
Yeah, I mean, so going off of that, right, like access has been completely democratized, right? Yeah. Like there is very little barrier to entry. And so anyone can get their music out there, which is great. But it also makes things difficult in a way, too, because I think the last statistic was that 100,000 songs are uploaded to DSPs every single day, right? Mm-hmm. So think about that. Think about the fact also that Spotify just also released information that starting this year, songs that don't track at least 1,000 streams per calendar year won't receive any royalties at all. So there's it's great that we are able to invite artists and invite people to contribute and be a part of this, but it also makes it really difficult to have a career. And so I think the roles that major labels play still kind of occupy a very similar space, which is what do you want to be? What do you want to do, right? Taylor Swift is obviously very fresh and still on everyone's minds. If you want to be Taylor Swift, a lot of the times you need a record label, right? Mm-hmm. Record labels...
to get that scale.
In my mind, right, record labels are a bank and a vast marketing engine. You know, they're a vast marketing vehicle to get out there. And so really... and a lot of this can be done independently, but when you're working with sort of a larger label or any label at that, you're kind of relying on the expertise of them to sort of analyze the marketplace, kind of see what the music sounds like. How do we get this to actually stand out in the sea of 100,000 tracks that are uploaded every single day?
And Jeff, I got to ask you a couple comments that we got today. Tim commented that according to Spotify, my favorite artist is Lee Morgan, but Tim only streams music these days. Langston writes, my favorite artist is Fitch Means, and to support them, I add my favorite artist songs in as many playlists as possible to generate streams. I got to ask you both, what is the best way to support an artist to make sure that your support actually impacts their bottom line?
I mean, if you're looking for direct contributions, merchandise, purchasing music directly if it's physical from the artist, and concert tickets, right, are usually the best ways of supporting an artist. You know, prior to the pandemic, about 80 to 85% of overall revenue for most major artists was coming from touring. That's been a little upset now coming back out of it with just so much traffic in the marketplace and increased costs for things. But, you know, merchandise is such a vital piece of, you know, revenue for, it's one of the biggest ancillary revenue streams for an artist. And when you think about Spotify's payout model, right, it's this pro rata payout model. It's basically a share, a proportion of how many streams they get into the overall proportion of how many streams the service got. So it's not just because I listened to Taylor Swift, you know, 20 times or 20,000 times, she's not getting my $15. That's in a proportion to all of the overall streams. And so the most transparent ways to transact and give money to an artist are those direct revenue streams, whether it's vinyl or a t-shirt or, you know, a poster, things like that.
And Brielle, that is that how people can actually, the money goes to you and not to Spotify in a way?
Yeah, I agree everything you said. Also, like, sites like Patreon are a great way to have concerts get comfortable performing. If you're kind of new, like the TikTok stars who may not have performed before, you can perform in your own space, and your fans can pay some sort of subscription or virtual ticket, and then that money is going to you directly.
Wow, they have so many new ways to make money. Well, yeah,
and some old ways too. Here's an email from Ryan in West Philly. I like this. Ryan says, CDs, vinyls, what about my analog cassettes? I probably have over 500 of them, including a huge number of live bootleg recordings. Clearly Ryan likes music. I rarely listen to them, but they're treasures of a time when tape trading was a huge factor in my music consumption. Lately, some indie bands have begun selling professionally produced cassettes at their shows. We're coming up on a break, Brielle, but what role do some of these older formats of music play in the livelihood of the modern artist, talking about cassettes, talking about vinyl, and even CDs?
I think it's making a comeback.
Yeah.
Especially with social media. Lots of kids now are getting into it, and maybe it's a fad for them, a trend, but, you know, having something tangible as artists grow, you want to feel like you're a part of that journey with them. So I think it's very smart to create tangible, physical music.
it's almost a derivative mm-hmm. of that idea of direct connection.
Yes,
absolutely.
That, and the like, pictures.
I'm with you on this journey. I follow you on social media. I bought something physical, whether it's a T-shirt, vinyl.
Right.
It kind of does seem like it all ties together a little bit.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I feel like you used to have the pictures. I remember that. They used to be looking at the pictures and seeing the lyrics written. And we're going to talk about vinyl coming up.
We are indeed. We're going to talk, in fact, with someone who runs a vinyl listening bar mm-hmm. here in Philadelphia. What is that? Well, we're going to tell you all about it after a break. You're listening to Studio 2 on WHYY 90.9. Stick with us.
Supporting WHYY, the Chamber of Commerce for Greater Philadelphia. Funded by the Knight Foundation, the Chamber announces its Leading the Way Cell and Gene Therapy in Greater Philadelphia report. More at chmbr.biz/CGTPHL.
And welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Today we have Jeff Apruzzi, Program Director of the Music Industry Program at Antoinette Westfall College of Media Arts and Design at Drexel University, and Brielle Kimmons, also known as April Fool Child. We also have Joey Sweeney, who's going to be talking in just a moment, creative director of 48 Record Bar, a listening bar in Philadelphia. And he'll talk about why vinyl is so hot right now. And we are talking generally about the music industry.
And in fact, let's bring in Joey right now. Hey, Joey, how are you doing?
Hey, it's great to be here.
So tell us a little bit about your business, 48 Record Bar. Where is it located? Take us to the scene. What does it feel like? And what do you guys do?
Great. We are a listening bar in Old City. We're at 48 South 2nd Street above Sassafras. And we opened right back around Thanksgiving. And we're a very small venue, a tiny kind of high-end cocktail bar. And we happen to have a really beautiful, high-quality audiophile sound system situated throughout the room, and a few hundred records on hand at any given time. And basically, if we are open, vinyl records are playing.
And Joey, got to ask you, vinyl is making this comeback. Is this a movement? And what is the special vibe that vinyl creates?
I am a lifelong vinyl collector, so the vicissitudes, like, I, you know, there's never not been a time in my life when records weren't a part of it. So my perspective is a little bit warped. But to answer your question, I think, you know, one of the reasons, and the rest of the panel were getting at it too, is that, you know, in the streaming era, and as the major labels have had, you know, ever diminishing cultural relevance, all of these old models are falling away. What is left and what is remaining is that musical culture kind of is physical culture.
Yeah. Mm.
If you are a working artist, the only ways you can make money are by selling merch, aka vinyl or tapes or CDs or whatever, or actually playing live gigs. And so, and that's it from the artist perspective. From the fan perspective, the more we are chained to our phones and our screens, vinyl offers a physical artifact. You know, you're interacting with the artwork, you are interacting with the sound. We had a post up on Instagram a few months ago that said, reclaim your time 22 minutes at a time. Mm-hmm. 22 minutes is the average length of the side of a full-length vinyl record. Mm-hmm. 22 minutes is long enough to, you know, kind of get your groove back, to, you know, to kind of to do a thing that is a little bit intentional, but also lets your mind wander. And okay. I think that that's a big piece of what is putting people back into vinyl.
That is Joey Sweeney, creative director of 48 Record Bar, a listening bar in Philadelphia. Joey, appreciate the time.
Cheers.
And talking about that connection to place and nostalgia, I want to read an email from Peggy, who says, my husband's brother died unexpectedly about 18 months ago, and just recently we found a box of CDs that he had burned for my husband in 2001. We played them on a cross-country trip this winter and loved hearing them, enjoying his taste in music. I'm just glad our vehicle still has a CD player. It's been a wonderful way to keep his memory alive. Thank you for that email, Peggy. That was lovely. Moving now to the future, Jeff, artificial intelligence and AI songwriting. It is here. It is happening. It is popping up left and right, even in rap feuds recently. So what is AI songwriting and what does it mean for musicians? I know that's a tough one.
Yeah, it's really interesting. So, I mean, AI songwriting in and of itself, there's a really crazy app called Suno. And a friend of mine posted a picture on Instagram the other day, right? And it said, create me a song in the style of Her and make it about Joe Biden. And within 3 seconds, it had a song.
Wow.
3 seconds, it had a song. Maybe I wouldn't listen to it, but the general public probably would not know that this was created by AI. And it's kind of fascinating. A colleague of mine, Joe Steinhardt, and I have been doing some research on AI-created music and fan acceptance, and we created basically these narratives where a band is recording a record, the lead singer passes away, and they use AI to finish the recording. And in both the scenarios, scenario one, we let the audience know, okay, we're using AI to finish this song. In scenario number two, we didn't let them know that we're using AI, but they use it anyway. And what's interesting is that the people that we sent the survey to, there are around 1,000 respondents globally, the fan culture, they actually didn't care that AI was used to finish the song. As long as they were made aware that it was used, they were okay with it. The discrepancies became for if songs are created using AI and people aren't made aware, they tend to not want to engage with it. And so I think it creates this really weird time in the music industry where, you know, are we getting to the place where music that's created by AI is going to sit, you know, toe to toe with music that is created solely by musicians? And then how do we evaluate those two pieces of work?
And I think about this recent dust up between the estate of Tupac and Drake, who used an AI rendition of Tupac, and it sounds just like him. And Tupac has been dead for more than 25 years at this point, and a diss track. And the family sent a cease and desist letter. Are we ready? And I just want you to come into the conversation, Brielle. What concerns do you have as an artist about AI?
Sure. I think it is concerning, right? Because we put our heart and soul into our music, the time, the energy, the feelings. But I think that organic feeling of music, like if you go to a live show and a band makes a mistake, we're going to appreciate that more. We're going to learn to appreciate that more because that won't happen with AI. It's pretty much perfect. So I think that gives us a fighting chance. And I think, you know, that organic sound will survive because of things like that. People are going to crave that authenticity even more.
So, of course, like everything, it's a threat, but there's opportunities and there's lanes opened up by the technology. I want to come back to you now, Jeff, and ask sort of a Philly-specific question. With all these changes in the music industry, is it easier or harder now to be based in a city like Philadelphia and make a living? And by that I mean not L.A., not Nashville, but a place that has a real music scene, you know, and is a major American city. I mean, do you think it's easier, harder now to be in a place like Philly?
Specifically speaking about Philadelphia, I think it is in a way easier.
Interesting.
I actually had been doing some research recently about the built environment of Philadelphia and specifically looking at the DIY music scene here. And if you look at sort of the physical makeup of the row homes and how the close proximity and our access to public transportation, you have this big coalescence of scenes and music and artists that are it's so easy for everyone to interact versus when you look at larger cities like New York or even Los Angeles, where you have so much segmentation of different genres and art, it really keeps things separated. And so there's this big melting pot, I would say, of music, genre, opportunity here. And I'm an outsider, right? I've only lived here for about 6 years. I've lived in New York and Los Angeles. And I do see this different sort of ecosystem here where the music scene is so supportive of one another. And to your earlier point, right, like living in a city like Philadelphia, you can afford to live here. You know, you live in these major cities, you might be working 40, 50 hours a week to pay your rent. And then how much time do you have left to work on your art? Like in cities like this, we have this great flourishing art scene. You can afford to live and spend a lot of your time honing in on your craft. Mm.
And Brielle is going to perform in just a couple minutes. And I have to ask you about performances because, you know, a couple people commented. One guy, Paul, says his favorite band is Phish. He sees them 3 to 5 times a year. 13 times was the most time he saw Phish in 1 year. Just sort of to piggyback on Avi's question, just sort of performance art, being able to perform in venues, does a city like Philadelphia encourage that? And given its proximity, does it just make it a little bit easier to make that real money?
Absolutely. I mean, I think live performance is sort of one of the biggest opportunities, again, to earn revenue for an artist, especially a major artist. And to Bria's earlier point, like there is that, the biggest thing is that fan engagement, right? Like to me, that is the biggest piece. And when I think about myself as a music fan, live performance is what really has made or break, like broken my love for a band, right? Like when I've seen a band perform and they just absolutely smash it, you go home and you listen to that record differently versus if you see a band perform and it kind of tanks, you're like, oh, I don't know anymore.
And I got to say, Brielle, I heard you perform live and I'm so excited you're in studio today and you have some live music with you. And this song is called
Expectations. Al, let's roll that tape and have Brielle play us out. Support Brielle Kimmins.
Yes, and tickets to live performances. Absolutely. That's how you support artists you love.
And Brielle, by the way, is known as April Fool Child. Thank you so much, Brielle, for the time today. That was lovely. That was beautiful. I needed that today. Thank you, Brielle.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
We also talked with Jeff Apruzzi, who is Program Director of the Music Industry Program at Antoinette Westfall College of Media Arts and Design at Drexel University. And I should note, a former member of the very influential indie band Passion Pit. We actually didn't bring that up, Jeff.
But I heard some of the music. I was like, I know this song.
That's right.
So that's really cool.
So obviously Jeff knows this stuff, and we really appreciate the time, Jeff.
Yes, and thank you to our producers today. I really love this show. Thanks to Debbie Builder, Paige Murray-Bessler, Andreas Copes, Al Banks engineered today's show. Joan Isabella is WHYY's audio general manager. From Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We will talk with you next week.